Chapter 6 American Mutation. Saturday, June 30th, 2018, was a warm day in Portland. Patriot Prayer, a conservative group headed by an evangelical preacher named Joey Gibson, organized a permitted march in downtown Portland. The right-wing gathering was met by hundreds of left-wing protesters. Ahead of the rally, Rose City Antifa created a Facebook event page titled Defend PDX, Patriot Prayer's Violence Must End. PDX is a moniker for Portland, taken from the airport code for Portland International Airport. The Facebook page accused Gibson of bringing in alt-right bullies, Nazis, homophobes, and unsavory characters to brutalize vulnerable people. "We are united in our opposition to the rise of fascism in this country, and we sure as hell will not let it take our streets." "No, pasaran," continued the post, ending with the Antifa Spanish-language rallying cry. As the right-wingers began their march, they were confronted by dozens in the Antifa black bloc. The two sides stared each other down. Suddenly, someone hurled a flashbang grenade at the right-wingers. Its explosion acted as the cue to brawl. Both sides rushed toward each other with fists, sticks, and batons swinging. Those knocked to the ground were pummeled and stomped on. Antifa militants wearing helmets hurled rocks and bottles. No police were around as people beat each other bloody. After both sides regrouped, more fighting broke out on a nearby street. Then the punch happened. A masked, black-clad militant with a collapsible baton was joined by his comrades. He took a swing at a right-winger and knocked him to the ground. Then he made eye contact with the 28-year-old Ethan Nordine, a Proud Boy member from Washington State. He swung twice and hit Nordine with the baton. Nordine didn't flinch and punched the Antifa militant in the face, knocking him unconscious and sending his sunglasses off into the distance. He collapsed to the ground and was dragged away by his comrades. The punch was captured on video, and the footage became an internet sensation to Donald Trump fans across America. To many conservative Americans who don't follow the esoteric politics of Antifa, the footage was simple to understand. Antifa started a fight with a Trump supporter and lost. That violent summer in Portland, I was traveling the United Kingdom and Europe to work on stories for an unrelated beat. But the videos and photos out of my hometown made their way to the international press, giving me an opportunity to ask locals what they thought of this new American phenomenon. They weren't surprised. "You're just seeing this now there? We've had hooligan street fights for decades," said one Englishman. He pointed out the shaved heads and punk-style clothing of some of the Antifa militants. Before Antifa made its way to the United States, it spread to Britain first from continental Europe. There, it cross-pollinated with the punk subculture, creating a uniquely English-language form of Antifa. British Antifa. Before developing an American offshoot, Antifa found footing in Britain in the 1970s punk rock music scene, particularly through the Oi subculture, which brought together punks and skinheads from the London working class. Though skinheads are now commonly thought of as being associated with neo-Nazis, skinhead subculture can be left-wing, right-wing, or apolitical. Its origin in London in the late 1960s was particularly multiracial, taking strong influence from Jamaican street culture and music. But by the mid-1970s, a strain of it was influenced by far-right racist ideology. Mark Bray, the Antifa historian and author, says this was caused by economic stagnation during the time and strong recruitment efforts by the National Front, a British party founded in 1967. In response to the development of far-right skinhead subculture in the 1970s and 1980s, a counter-movement of anti-racist skinheads formed. On the surface, they looked visually similar. They sported very short or shaved heads, bomber jackets, Fred Perry polo shirts, and steel-toed Doc Martens boots. But more subtle cues, such as bootlace colours, tattoos and patches, would signal which ideological faction one belonged to. At punk shows, they often fought each other. The fighting became ritualised and an act to show up for in and of itself. As Britain struggled with instances of organised far-right violence targeting South Asian immigrant and black communities, a plethora of militant left-wing groups formed to oppose them. In 1985, the Anti-Fascist Action was formed in London. It was made up of members who belonged to numerous other far-left groups, like Red Action and the Direct Action movement. The Anti-Fascist Action took inspiration from the original German Antifa paramilitary and made it a primary goal to fight far-right groups like the National Front and the British National Party. In many ways, it was a small-scale repeat of the far-left versus far-right street battles that plagued the Weimar Republic in the interwar years. The militant Antifa organising in Britain during the 1980s could be argued as legitimate, or at least more legitimate than the American manifestation that has become popular since 2016. First, the war against the fascist Axis powers took place on European soil, and the Nazi Luftwaffe bombing campaigns in Britain were still in living memory. But even before that, actual fascist party organising was part of the mainstream British political landscape in the 20th century. The British Union of Fascists, BUF, led by Oswald Mosley, had up to 50,000 members at its peak in 1934. The BUF organised rallies that were protected by its own paramilitary, the Fascist Defence Force. They wore black uniforms. They were involved in a number of notoriously violent clashes against protesters. The most notorious riot of all is known as the Battle of Cable Street, named after the large-scale fighting that occurred on Cable Street in East London in October 1936. Upward of 20,000 counter-protesters, some estimates put this number much higher, organised to fight the 2,000 to 3,000 BUF members who were escorted by police. Mosley eventually had his black shirts retreat from the march, while rioters moved on to fighting cops. The Battle of Cable Street remains one of the most important mythos for contemporary Antifa groups in establishing and legitimising a physical force tradition. This is a trait of extremist groups. An analogy to Antifa is the Irish Republican Army, who also romanticise violent heroism. Its ideologues use the 1916 Irish uprising against the British as justification for the deadly terrorist acts it carried out on UK soil in the second half of the 20th century. Antifa literature and propaganda cite the Battle of Cable Street, and later other clashes against the National Front and British National Party, as a prime example of how mass violent direct action can stop fascist organising. But this is wrong. What stopped the far-right parties from organising was their falling out of favour with voters due to their extremism. Mosley's British Union of Fascists lost significant popular support for its open embrace of anti-Semitism. During World War II, the group's members were interned, and Mosley later exiled himself to France, where he eventually died. The National Front had its best electoral performance at some local elections in the mid-1970s, though it never managed to get even 1% of the national vote at its peak. Membership of the party rapidly declined by the late 1970s, and the party is obsolete today. This history of fascism in Britain over the course of a century was accompanied by a long history of mainstream anti-fascism as well. But today, communists, socialists, and anarchists claim a monopoly on anti-fascism and define it to mean something entirely else. As for Antifa's cross-pollination with British punk music and punk culture, it was a lasting influence that aligned the ideology toward anti-authoritarianism and anarchism. This form of Antifa, different from its German communist origin, eventually was exported to the United States. American Antifa. Though American Antifa groups today are associated with left-wing West Coast cities like Portland and Seattle, the first Antifa groups to emerge in the United States actually came out of the American Midwest. In the late 1980s, a group of far-left skinheads known as the Baldies began meeting in Minneapolis to strategize how to oppose the far-right skinhead movement that was growing in the American neo-Nazi scene. The Baldies believed violence was the appropriate way to respond. They were influenced by British extremist anarchist papers like Black Flag and Class War, publications that encouraged violence and insurrectionist behavior. Together with other left-wing skinheads from across the Midwest, they formed one of the first known American Antifa networks. Made up of numerous groups, such as the Anti-Racist Action, they named the network the Syndicate. The Anti-Racist Action had a model of organizing violence to oppose or disrupt what they say are far-right groups and individuals. It is the immediate precursor to contemporary American Antifa groups. Their tactics and ideology were taken directly from the UK Anti-Fascist Action, who in turn took inspiration from the German Communist Party's Antifaschistische Aktion. According to Mark Bray, who interviewed an early Anti-Racist Action member, the group decided to name itself the Anti-Racist Action rather than the Anti-Fascist Action because fascism sounded like a dogmatic leftist term in an American context. A simpler explanation is that until recently, the word racism had much more political resonance in the United States than fascism. America's history is marred by state-sanctioned and state-enforced racism, and its war against actual fascism was never fought on U.S. soil. Throughout the late 1980s and into the 1990s and 2000s, militant Antifa organizing remained on the margins of society, as did neo-Nazi and KKK organizing. While traditional fascism has not been part of modern American political culture, unlike countries in Europe, there have been many far-right white identity groups and inspired lone wolves operating outside the American mainstream. Their involvement in violence and intimidation of minority groups have been extensively covered by government agencies, news media, pop culture, and cinema. From 1997 to 2006, the FBI tracked an average of 7,900 hate incidents a year, of which 46% were intimidation-related and 31.9% were simple assaults. Thousands of reported hate incidents a year may sound like a lot, but the United States has a steadily growing population of more than 320 million people. Calculated as an incident rate, it is less than 2.5 incidents per 100,000 people. Additionally, looking closer at the data reveals nuance. Whites are underrepresented as offenders at less than 60%. They make up more than 76% of the US population. Blacks are overrepresented as more than 20% of offenders, compared to being around 13% of the overall population. Further, the number of FBI-tracked hate incidents have declined since 2006, even though more agencies are reporting data. Although hate crimes are relatively rare in the United States, each and every anecdote has the potential to create social trauma and panic. For example, the murder of 9 black parishioners in Charleston, South Carolina, by far-right shooter Dylan Roof in 2015 has more lasting salience than the murder of 14 people by a jihadist husband and wife in San Bernardino, California, the same year. People remember the homicide of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville, Virginia, in 2017, but few know the name of the victim killed by an Antifa shooter in Portland in 2020. Stories of violent white racism, though exceptionally rare, are impactful to the American public because they remind us of American history. Antifa exploit this sensitivity to justify their own violent extremism. Antifa and academe. In 2017, Milo Yiannopoulos was scheduled to speak at the University of California, Berkeley. By then, the right-wing provocateur had already completed a number of speaking gigs across the United States as part of his Breitbart news-sponsored tour. He and his entourage of cameramen and assistants were transported in a rockstar-style tour bus with the name of the show printed across its side, The Dangerous Faggot Tour. The text was accompanied by a large cartoon of a regal-looking Yiannopoulos being carried by four muscular men. "Why do lesbians fake so many hate crimes?" was the title of his speech in September 2016 at Texas Tech University. At Louisiana State University, fat shaming works. The speeches continued across the United States in the autumn and winter of 2016 and into 2017. One by one, the speeches defiled the sacred cows of the left. 10 things I hate about Islam. Trannies are gay. Why ugly people hate me. No more dead babies. As the tour moved westward, it attracted larger protests and angrier people. Soon, outside left-wing groups organized to join their comrades on campus. Among them were Antifa. While early protests produced comical footage primed for viral memes, such as scenes of screaming and crying students, the Antifa came equipped with weapons. Yiannopoulos, an editor at Breitbart at the time, was protected by professional security. However, his fans had none and bore the brunt of violence from rioters while waiting in line outside auditoriums. On January 20th, 2017, at the University of Washington, UW, in Seattle, it was nearly deadly. In the coincidentally named Red Square, hundreds of anarchists and left-wingers confronted Trump supporters. Many of them were in black bloc. In addition to their hatred of Yiannopoulos, tensions had reached a peak because it was also Inauguration Day. Left-wing militants hurled bricks and other projectiles at law enforcement, who tried to keep the two sides separated. Just as Yiannopoulos was about to speak inside Kane Hall, a shooting occurred outside. Joshua Phelan Dukes, a 35-year-old Antifa militant, also known as Hex, was shot in the abdomen by Elizabeth Hokawana. She claimed that Dukes had rushed toward her husband, a conservative Asian American man, with a knife. At trial in August 2019, Dukes refused to testify, and the jury failed to reach a consensus. The judge declared a mistrial. Nevertheless, the Dangerous Faggot Tour continued. Yiannopoulos headed to Northern California next. Only a week and a half after the UW shooting, he was scheduled to speak at UC Berkeley on invitation by the Berkeley College Republicans. Though hundreds of tickets were sold and the venue was booked, Yiannopoulos never got to speak. On the evening of February 1st, 2017, an estimated 1,500 protesters amassed outside Sproul Hall to shut down the event. Around 150 of them were masked in the black bloc, carrying communist and anarchist flags. Many of the militants belonged to By Any Means Necessary, BAM, a Bay Area militant Antifa group previously involved in organizing violent Black Lives Matter protests. In 2002, BAM was investigated by the FBI for suspected terrorist activities, though the group was never charged. Only months after Donald Trump's election and days after his inauguration, left-wing activists and militants across the country joined causes to stop what they say was American fascism. Yiannopoulos was one of Trump's loudest cheerleaders, and he dared to trespass in progressive coastal cities viewed as safe spaces to the left. Going to UC Berkeley, one of America's most left-wing universities, was not just a poke at a hornet's nest, but the kicking of several nests. Nearby cities include the progressive bastions of Oakland and San Francisco. Protesters and militant leftists from across the region converged on the campus to violently shut down the event. Despite lines of police on duty near the Berkeley Student Union, officers were unable to stop or contain the violence. As at UW, Antifa militants pepper-sprayed and attacked those standing in line outside. They used sticks to hit people and threw rocks and fireworks at law enforcement. Stolen MAGA hats were set on fire, leading to cheers from the mob. UC Berkeley Police Chief Margot Bennett said Molotov cocktails were also thrown. Antifa stole metal barricades, originally set up to separate attendees and protesters. They used the barriers as impromptu weapons to smash the student union's windows. Large mobile lights set up to illuminate the plaza were knocked over and set on fire. The crowd cheered and celebrated the sight of the destruction. Even after Yiannopoulos' speech was cancelled, the militants continued to riot. Police stood by and watched. The rioters slowly made their way to downtown Berkeley, where they smashed business windows and ransacked the interiors. Yvette Felarka, a leader in BAM who was at the riot and participated in the summer 2016 protest at the state capitol that had become violent, told local media the protest was a success. "I think shutting down and forcing the cancellation of a white supremacist like Milo Yiannopoulos was a stunning achievement," she told Berkeleyside News that night. "This is about our right to be free of intimidation." Given free rein by sympathetic elected officials, Antifa's violence continued in the city. On April 15, 2017, Eric Clanton, who was an adjunct professor at a local college, allegedly assaulted several people with a heavy bike lock. Viral video footage of one incident allegedly showed a masked Clanton using the bike lock to smash the head of a Trump supporter in Berkeley. Clanton was arrested and ultimately pleaded no contest to one misdemeanor charge, but his felony assault charges were dismissed. He was sentenced to only probation in a sweetheart deal. Clanton is not the only academic to be involved in Antifa. There's also Mark Bray, the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And during the 2020 Portland riots, those arrested included professors and instructors from various academic institutions in the Portland area. The campus far-left violence and rioting involving students and academics in early 2017 were only the beginning. On the other side of the country, around 200 students at Middlebury College in Vermont shut down a scheduled speaking lecture featuring American Enterprise Institute scholar Charles Murray in March 2017. They accused the political scientist of racism and fascism for his 1994 book The Bell Curve, which in one chapter compared psychometric disparities across population groups. An online profile by the Southern Poverty Law Center declaring Murray a white nationalist was also shared among activists to rally them to shut down the event. Unable to speak on stage due to the shouting and chants, Murray was ushered to another room where he spoke to a camera that live-streamed the footage. By that point, students outside the hall were joined by Antifa militants in the parking lot, many dressed in black bloc. Campus security attempted to escort Murray and Alice Stanger, a professor at Middlebury, to a vehicle that was supposed to whisk them away from campus. but they were confronted by violent left-wing militants and Antifa who prevented them from getting to the car. Stanger said that during the attack she was shoved and had her hair forcefully yanked, leading to a neck injury that required hospitalization. "We intercepted them between the door and the car and surrounded them with signs and chanting and clapping," said one of the Antifa to Politico at the time. "And really, just like letting Charles Murray know that you can't come to this campus and expect to leave without repercussions." Once Murray and the professor made it inside the car, Antifa surrounded the vehicle and prevented it from leaving. Security desperately pushed rioters out of the path of the car, but they kept regrouping. Once the car nearly made it out of the parking lot, one of the Antifa jumped on its hood. The driver drove down the block with the militant still on top before slamming on the brakes, causing the attacker to fall off. The Antifa promptly took off running before Middlebury police arrived at the scene. As witnessed in other cities, swarming cars and attacking those inside is a riot method of choice for Antifa. Antifa violence on American university campuses continued month after month in 2017. In May, dozens of radical left-wing students at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, shut down a biology class taught by Professor Brett Weinstein. They took issue with his emails expressing concern over the university's planned Day of Absence event, where whites were asked to stay away from campus. Protests continued the following day, leading to several hundred rioters barricading doors and windows so that the university president and administrators could not leave. They demanded radical changes and the firing of Weinstein. The following month, the university cancelled classes for 2 days following a violent threat that was phoned in. During this time, rioters roamed the campus with sticks and baseball bats, causing $10,000 in property damage. On June 15, 2017, the Evergreen Anti-Fascist Community Defense Network organized a mass gathering on campus to confront a small rally by Patriot Prayer, the Portland area conservative group. Violent skirmishes initiated by Antifa militants in the Red Square led to Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson being left bloodied in the face. Law enforcement were there in large numbers, but responded only after violence reached a high threshold. There were over 100 left-wing protesters, many of them in black block and ready for battle. They held signs that read, "Black Lives Matter," and "America Was Never Great." After being separated from the other side by police, who had set up metal barriers, they used whatever they could gather to hurl as projectiles. Although most protesters at the event were politically polarized, a dozen people observed from the sideline. Alex Pearson, a junior at Evergreen State at the time, told me he supported racial justice but didn't agree with all of the militant tactics. "If you're not to the level of where they are, you have the risk of being put with the complete opposite people," he told me. On the day of absence, Pearson, who is white, said he accidentally attended class, a mistake his peers made sure he knew. In 2017, I was unknown to most people as a no-name student journalist. The anonymity allowed me to more easily ask Antifa militants for interviews. All declined that day except for one young woman. "People frame Antifa very poorly and call them terrorists," she said. "Theoretically, I haven't heard of Antifa beating up any minorities ever." After the rally, several of the right-wingers' cars were found vandalized. The tires were completely slashed. I didn't witness who committed the vandalism, but earlier in the day I observed a group of masked people monitoring cars as drivers pulled into the campus parking lot. Some of the masked people took photos of the vehicle license plates. This information, I would later learn, is used in Antifa-compiled dossiers on their opponents. Known as doxing, They release addresses, car details, and employment information to the public so that their victims can be hounded en masse. The campus violence and far-left radicalism continued through 2017 and into 2020. Each year appeared to show students' willingness to be more extreme than the previous one. On Halloween 2020, around 150 students from Northwestern University joined forces with outside agitators to riot in Evanston, Illinois, at an anti-police protest. They smashed windows, threw bricks, and hurled explosive mortar fireworks at Evanston police officers. They also used high-powered lasers to blind police. Northwestern University is one of the world's most prestigious private research institutions, and yet a faction of its student body organized and behaved exactly as the Antifa who riot in Portland and other cities. How did American institutions of higher learning become breeding grounds for far-left violent extremism? Critical theory. Antifa do not view their premeditated and preemptive acts of violence as violence. It is part of the strategy of remaking words to have completely new meanings. But it also pulls from a left-wing philosophical tradition established by 20th-century German philosopher and socialist Herbert Marcuse. Marcuse is one of the most important philosophers and social theorists to the modern left. His theories and ideas form the ideological pillars for many so-called social justice and Antifa movements today, even without its adherents realizing so. Born in Berlin in 1898, Marcuse was a committed leftist all his life. As a young adult, he studied the writings of Karl Marx and voted for the German Communist Party. In 1933, he joined the Institute for Social Research, a think tank at Frankfurt University. It is more commonly known as the Frankfurt School. With the rise of fascism in Europe, many of the intellectuals at the Frankfurt School escaped to the United States, where they became faculty and influential thinkers. Columbia University in New York City took in a number of Frankfurt academics. One of the Frankfurt School's lasting legacies is the development of critical theory, the Marxist-inspired theory that undergirds all the various studies disciplines in academia today. In short, critical theorists develop ways to criticize perceived structures and systems of oppression in order to bring about radical change. It offers a heuristic for understanding all human interaction through power dynamics between groups. When applied to race, concepts like white privilege, whiteness, and intersectionality purport to explain why there are disparities in outcomes among racial groups. Colloquially, critical theory is sometimes referred to as cultural Marxism, an application of Marxist theory to groups of people based on identity rather than class. Many dogmas of critical theory have become so mainstream in American academe and society that people don't even know the origins of those truth claims. Have you heard it argued that there is no such thing as objective reality and truth? Social justice ideologues use this dogma to deconstruct science. Biological sex, for example. That's from critical theory. What about words are violence? Antifa's militants cite this to justify their violent behavior against opposing views. This is also from critical theory. Marcuse became known as the father of the New Left for his ideological influence on left-wing student protest movements in the 1960s and 1970s, particularly through establishing the now far-left foundational belief that tolerance means actively suppressing intolerant, usually right-wing, ideas. In 1965, Marcuse co-authored a book with sociologist Robert Paul Wolff and philosopher Barrington Moore Jr. titled A Critique of Pure Tolerance. Marcuse's essay in the book, Repressive Tolerance, laid the foundation for redefining tolerance to mean militant intolerance toward prevailing policies, attitudes, opinions, and the extension of tolerance to policies, attitudes, and opinions which are outlawed or suppressed. In other words, we should not allow perceived intolerant ideas the space to be expressed and should be more accepting of extreme beliefs on the left. For decades, American academe has been marinating in Marcuse's ideas, spreading it to students who then form the next generation of politicians, leaders, and activists. Even stalwart civil liberty organizations like the ACLU, now filled with members educated in this worldview, have been retreating quietly from their principle of defending free speech. In a 2018 document sent to members titled ACLU Case Selection Guidelines, Conflicts Between Competing Values or Priorities, the organization responded to the onslaught of resignations and criticisms it received after defending the right of the alt-right to march in Charlottesville. In August 2017, the ACLU supported Unite the Right organizer Jason Kessler in his lawsuit against the city when it forced him to relocate his permitted rally. However, the 2018 guidelines in response to left-wing criticism stated that a decision by the ACLU to represent a white supremacist group may directly further an agenda that is antithetical to our mission and values, and that may inflict harm on listeners. The mainstream left's retreat from liberal values of free speech has worked to the benefit of Antifa in every way imaginable. Now, not only are large factions of the left sympathetic to Antifa violence, some are actively working to suppress their opponents through getting corporate businesses and big tech to ban them. One small sample analysis of public figures banned or suspended on Twitter from 2005 to 2019, published on Quillette, showed that with only one exception, all are right-wing. On the surface, that doesn't necessarily show evidence of political bias, since different groups have different behaviours and thus different outcomes. But given the left's documented abuse anti-white of Twitter's policies through doxing and calls to violence and racism, it's fair to question the disparate treatment. The consequences of legitimizing left-wing extremism don't stay within the realm of academe, corporations, or big tech. It spills out onto the street through what Antifa does best: violent hooliganism and street thuggery. That type of urban violence is nothing new, but we're beginning to witness a growing tolerance and support for it from factions of mainstream society. In 2020, the recurring theme from the left in response to mass BLM and Antifa violence in the streets is people over property. Indeed, an author named Vicky Osterweil, who uses the Twitter username @Vicky_ACAP, was championed by the mainstream press for her book In Defense of Looting, published in August 2020. NPR interviewed Osterweil, who argued that looting is moral. The very basis of property in the US is derived through whiteness and through black oppression, through the history of slavery and settler domination of the country, she said in the interview with reporter Natalie Escobar. Looting strikes at the heart of property, of whiteness, and of the police. It gets to the very root of the way those three things are interconnected, and also it provides people with an imaginative sense of freedom and pleasure and helps them imagine a world that could be. This is verbatim what Antifa say when they are asked to justify why they try to burn down businesses and homes. What the journalists, pundits, and intelligentsia don't understand is that at Antifa riots, there is really no line between property destruction and assault. One bleeds into the other, as they all serve the same purpose of chaos and violence. How did Antifa develop such a close relationship with radical students on American campuses? Over and over, we witness students and outside Antifa militant groups working hand in hand to carry out violence, threats, disruption, or harassment against targets at institutions that are supposed to uphold free speech and open inquiry. This close relationship is a unique development of Antifa in the North American context. Although contemporary European Antifa groups grew out of the tradition of radical left-wing student protests in West Germany in the 1960s, what is happening in the United States and Canada more recently demonstrates a unique cross-pollination of several radical ideologies: Marxism, anarchism, and critical theory. American Antifa has the communist and anarchist origins of European Antifa, but it has evolved to include contemporary social justice politics from critical theory. Intersectionality flows through American Antifa. The revolution they are fighting for will not be led by workers, but rather trans, black, and indigenous folks of color. The radical influence travels in both directions. Campus social justice politics are now much more tolerant, if not encouraging, of extremism. Few students who have engaged in the violent shutdown of events or people have ever been held accountable by the university administrations. In some cases, like the students who mobbed and harassed a Yale professor over a non-issue Halloween costume controversy in 2015, were actually awarded by the university administration for enhancing race relations. The mutation of Antifa in America didn't end with its embrace of academic critical race theory and campus riots. The rise of Antifa coincides with the rise of BLM. Both movements share an ideology that seeks to upend American liberal democracy and the rule of law. They have important differences from one another, but their mutual hatred of the United States has brought them together to form a powerful, dangerous union.